Significant social and economic shifts within Europe were intensified, where they weren't directly caused by war. The move from rural to industrializing regions, from south and east to western Europe, was one characteristic, a long-term trend that the pressures of war hugely exacerbated. The massive displacement of population through war and ethnic cleansing was a more short-term consequence of political upheavals, though with long-term consequences. Before the First World War, emigration to the United States had offered one escape route from the grinding poverty of the poorest regions of Europe. But once the USA introduced strict immigration quotas in the early 1920s, the exodus fell to little more than a trickle. Most people looking for a better life or fleeing from persecution had to find new homes within Europe itself. For economic migrants, this meant in the main looking for employment in the burgeoning industrial areas. The flow of migrants from the countryside to the towns, a strong feature of the economic recovery during the 1920s, declined but didn't stop during the Depression of the 1930s. Everywhere, the population working on the land shrank. In 1910, agriculture had in Europe as a whole accounted for about 55% of production. By 1950, this had fallen to 40%. The biggest shift from the land to industry was in Russia, accounting for as much as half of the overall drop in the agricultural share. But in all countries, the size of the rural population was falling. Industrialized Bohemia drew in workers from rural Slovakia. Milan and Turin attracted migrants from southern Italy. Poles moved from the south and east of the country to the more rapidly industrializing western region. And large numbers from eastern and southern Europe found permanent work in the growing industries of Germany, France, and the Netherlands. France, with its stagnant population levels, which would in fact be ended during the Second World War when there was a sharp rise, saw the greatest need for foreign labour between the wars. By 1931, about 8% of the French population, some 3.3 million people, were recent immigrants. The long-term shifts, rural to urban areas, agriculture to industry, south and east to north and west, were sharply boosted by the Second World War. Germany, with full employment, had by 1939 close to 500,000 foreign workers, despite its xenophobic state ideology. Nearly 50% of them, including Poles, Italians, Yugoslavs, Hungarians, Bulgarians, and Dutch, worked often seasonally on the land, where there was an acute labour shortage. But industry, too, was swallowing up larger numbers of foreign workers, from Czechoslovakia especially. The increasingly desperate German demand for labour during the war brought a huge surge in the number of foreigners, about a third of them women, most of them conscripted for intensely cruel forced labour, especially from 1942 onwards. By mid-1944, the 7,651,970 foreigners, 1,930,087 of them prisoners of war, comprised more than a quarter of the German labour force. Germany was able to exploit a continent-wide empire for its labour needs, and did so in utterly ruthless fashion. But in all belligerent countries, war brought a massive increase in demand for labour. Much of the shortfall, as men were called to the front, was made up by women. This had happened in the First World War, but the change had then proved short-term. Women were soon removed from the labour market as men returned from military action. In the Second World War, the change became more enduring. Unemployment in Britain, which had seemed endemic between the wars, was wiped out. Women, housewives and those previously not employed, or who had left domestic service, comprised more than three-quarters of the added labour force. In the Soviet Union, where women were already widely employed before the war, more than half the labour force was female by 1942. The most sudden and violent internal shifts in Europe's population in the first half of the 20th century were, of course, not simply a consequence of long-term trends in the labour market, even when boosted by the demands of wartime economies. Far more drastic were the population upheavals caused by political and military action. These were most dire in Eastern Europe, though the Spanish Civil War produced some 2 million refugees between 1936 and 1938. Nearly 8 million people were displaced in the eastern half of the continent, mostly through territorial losses, border shifts, and ethnic adjustments of emergent new states, during or immediately after the First World War. Up to 1 million Armenians were uprooted, and most of them subsequently died in the horrific deportations by the Turks in 1915. Nearly 1 million Greeks and Turks were forcibly removed under the post-war population exchange of 1923. In Russia, devastated by the civil war that followed immediately upon World War and revolution, the numbers of dead and those forced to flee have been estimated at over 10 million. Millions more died or were displaced during the era of Stalinist collectivization and purges in the 1930s. Then still further millions who fled eastwards from the path of the advancing German army in 1941. Stalin's wartime mass deportations of those deemed to pose a security threat brought yet further huge migrations, for example, through the forced removal of 400,000 Volga Germans to the Soviet wastes of Central Asia and Siberia in 1941, and later the mass deportations of the Crimean Tatars, together with the Kalmyks, Ingushi, Karachai, Balkars, and Chechens, about 1 million in all, from the Caucasus. By late 1941, the murder of the European Jews was rapidly escalating. Hundreds of thousands of refugees from Nazi Germany, most of them Jews, had sought succor in other countries before the war, though these had been reluctant to accept them. About half of them had found their way abroad, mainly to the USA and Palestine. But the war closed off these avenues of escape. Around 5.5 million Jews perished in the subsequent German extermination policies. The border changes and expulsions after the end of the Second World War then led to further great population displacements. A third of the population of the new Federal Republic of Germany in 1950, for instance, hadn't been born within its territory. Its population influx would go on to make a vital contribution to West German post-war recovery. The bald statistics of population displacement, like all macroeconomic data, are wholly impersonal. They say nothing of the death, destruction, suffering, and misery involved. Even so, they are important in signifying change that in many ways altered the character of 20th century Europe. Equally impersonal are the data showing, on different criteria, that living standards actually rose across Europe during the catastrophic first half of the century, at least for the majority of those whose lives weren't lost or ruined by fighting, bombing, despoliation, or deliberately murderous policies. Alongside rising life expectancy, income per head increased by over 25%. There was greater purchasing power for the majority. Average individual height grew by 4 centimeters, an indicator of better diet as well as more income, and literacy was substantially extended. Although, of course, these trends conceal major variations caused by war and other privations, they were broadly general across the continent. The regions that had been least well-developed before the First World War in southern and eastern Europe showed distinct signs of convergence with the more advanced western parts of the continent before the Second World War. War and the economy. Learning lessons. Each of the world wars was a catastrophic, though relatively short-lived, interruption to long-term economic development. Average growth rates in most European states were lower over the disastrous era of 1914 to 45 than before the First or after the Second World War. And it took the defeated countries in the First World War around a decade to recover. But they did recover. And growth, if slower than it had been before the war, continued. It has been estimated that had pre-war growth before 1914 continued unabated, the level reached in world production by 1929 would have been attained in foodstuffs by 1923, in industrial goods by 1924, and in raw materials by 1927. Whatever caveats may be attached to such extrapolations, which are for world, not just European production, they indicate a temporary break on growth through the hostilities, not a long-term reversal. The levels of globalization reached before 1914 were hampered and interrupted by war, then by protectionism and economic nationalism during the Great Depression of the 1930s. European economic output then fell again during the Second World War, and much of what was produced had, of course, to be geared to military hardware. This time, however, the rebound was swift. Following the Second World War, growth was rapid, much stronger than in the aftermath of the First World War, and with more lasting impact. Lessons had been learnt. There was a readiness to embrace international cooperation, so badly lacking between the wars, but now accepted as vital to recovery. New levels of state intervention were undertaken to restore stability and regulate the economy. The decisive factor was the complete economic dominance of the USA and its crucial export of ideas, technology, and capital. The basis for the unprecedented economic growth over the subsequent three decades was laid, however, within Europe itself and in the continent's darkest years. For in strictly economic terms, war, even on the scale of the conflicts of 1914 to 18 and 1939 to 45, didn't merely have a negative balance sheet of losses. It also had positive consequences of lasting importance. The conditions of war provided a marked stimulus to economic growth and technological advance. Even democratic states, let alone dictatorships, were forced to intervene massively in the economy to direct enormously expanded production for the war effort. This necessitated state investment in construction, capital equipment, and labor training as the conflict created new demand, which often proved lasting. For instance, for aluminium needed in aircraft production during the Second World War. Mass production of armaments required, already in the First World War, more efficient methods of factory organization and management, and more intensive mechanization. Agriculture benefited from increased mechanization to maximize production from the land at a time when farms were drained of labor. Around 3,000 new tractors were made available to farmers in Britain during the first year of the Second World War, for example, and production of all types of agricultural machinery was increased. In Germany, on the other hand, where the increasingly frantic demand for tanks, guns, and planes left little productive capacity over for tractors, farmers had generally to make do with the efforts of family members, forced foreign labor, and prisoners of war. Here, as in other parts of the continent, where the modernization of farming methods made little headway during the war itself, the mechanization of agriculture and intensification of production largely had to await the era of post-war reconstruction, since there was no way of reversing the relentless long-term decline in availability of rural labour during the period of the conflict. Technological and scientific innovation was striking in both wars, quite especially in the second, and with lasting effect. It wasn't necessarily the case that war produced entirely new discoveries, yet even where a breakthrough had been made in peacetime, the urgency of wartime production often brought rapid advances. Aircraft technology had improved massively during the First World War, since aerial warfare was viewed as decisive in any future conflict, and the innovations fed into the expansion of passenger aviation during the 1920s and 1930s. The jet engine, simultaneously invented and developed in the 1930s by the British Royal Air Force engineer Frank Whittle and the German engineer Hans von Ohain, though first mass-produced in Germany in 1944 for the Me-262 fighter, would revolutionize air travel after the Second World War. Later, space exploration would build upon the rocket technology that Wernher von Braun and other German scientists had developed to launch the V-2 missile. The abilities of Braun, a Nazi Party member and honorary SS officer, were swiftly recognized by the Americans and transported to a new environment in the USA. He would play a major role in the development of the American space program. The discovery of nuclear fission on the eve of the war, which led to the wartime program in the USA to produce an atomic bomb, opened the way to the post-war peaceful usage of nuclear energy. Many more wartime innovations or rapid advances on existing technology, for example, radio transmission, radar, production of synthetic materials, electronic computers, were to have a massive impact on the post-war era. Without the war, these advances, many of which built on pre-war pioneers, would doubtless have come about anyway. Most likely, however, their development would have been slower. The Second World War was, to a far greater extent than the First, a total war, not just for societies under dictatorial rule. The leaders of states learned important lessons from the earlier war in running their wartime economies. They were far more effective than their predecessors had been, for instance, in controlling inflation, which was never allowed to gain destructive momentum as in some belligerent countries during the First World War. In Britain, taxation was raised to far higher levels than it had been in the earlier conflict, reducing the need for short-term borrowing. And it enabled the government to continue to borrow long-term at relatively low rates of interest. In Germany, where the paranoia about any new descent into hyperinflation was never far from the surface, taxation could be kept much lower than in Britain, because the soaring costs of war were paid in large measure by the occupied territories. Germany and Britain were at opposite ends of the spectrum too in state control of the food supply to their populations. The unstoppable momentum of rising disaffection in Germany during the First World War, as living standards fell drastically and food shortages became acute, was deeply embedded in the political consciousness of Nazi leaders. Their ruthless exploitation of the continent's food and other resources prevented any recurrence during the Second World War. The first significant cuts in rations, made following the winter crisis of 1941-42, were highly unpopular. But drastic reductions didn't occur until the final phase of the war. Occupied countries in much of Europe paid the price, with mounting severe food shortages reaching famine proportions in Ukraine and Greece, and near famine in the hunger winter of 1944-45 in Holland. Although food prices were officially controlled and allocations rationed, the black market was rampant everywhere. In Britain, State subsidies and stringent rationing were used to ensure that food prices rose more slowly than farm incomes. The rationing of all staple foods except potatoes and bread inevitably gave rise to grumbling, but it was nevertheless widely accepted by the population and helped to sustain social harmony. It actually improved the health of many at the same time, though at the cost of dietary monotony. During the Second World War, leading figures from business and industry were brought in to help shape government policy even more than in the First World War. Industrialists were preoccupied not just with war production, but with planning for the post-war world. Even in Germany, where the Nazi regime tightened its grip on the economy, as on everything else, and where Allied bombs wrought ever greater destruction on the country, industrialists married their intense wartime collaboration with secret plans for reconstruction. Anxious not to be dragged into the futile self-immolation of the Nazi regime in its death throes during the last months of the war, they worked alongside the Reich Minister for Armaments and Production, Albert Speer, to block the senseless destruction of industrial installations under Hitler's scorched earth orders of March 1945. In fact, in Germany, the destruction of industry was nowhere near as great as the general level of devastation caused by the war, and industrialists were able to continue, in their own interest, their close involvement in measures to stimulate recovery. Much the same was true in other major economies. Mobilization for the war had unleashed enormous economic capacity, which was often badly damaged but not destroyed, while huge labor resources were available to be used for peacetime reconstruction instead of armaments. The potential for reconstruction lay dormant among the ruins. Recovery, like wartime economic mobilization, needed the state. The sheer level of material destruction in Europe made any retreat by the state from economic management impossible. Any belief that economies could repair themselves through market forces had been undermined by the economic nationalism of the interwar period. Only the state, French and British planners agreed, could provide the levels of investment necessary for the massive infrastructural projects to rebuild the economy. American leaders, though favoring the free market, could scarcely demur at this juncture, while rigid state control was, of course, long established in the Soviet Union. Huge house-building programs had to be organized. Food scarcity also demanded continued state controls and allocation. In Britain, rationing continued well into the 1950s. In the immediate years after the Second World War, the economy of Europe was accordingly shaped by levels of state expenditure and control in ways never contemplated in the 1920s and 1930s. Under American influence, however, Western Germany wouldn't come to follow the model of far greater dirigisme adopted in Britain and France, although in Eastern Germany under Soviet control, the development was of course entirely different. Experience of heavy state controls during the 12 years of Nazism would encourage the removal of constraints on the free market, the drastic reduction of bureaucratization, and the abolition of industrial cartels. Indeed, the initially high level of state intervention and direction would soon start to be pared back in most countries, though by then, recovery was well underway. The social impact of total war. By the time the Second World War was over, expectations that governments should do more to improve living conditions for their societies also compelled state intervention. Of course, expectations had been raised during the First World War too, even if these had for the most part afterwards been sorely disappointed. In one crucial area, however, notable progress had been made. under pressure from workers' parties, most of the economically more advanced countries in Europe had between the wars extended the limited social security provisions that some of them, notably Germany and Britain, had already introduced before 1914. There were still great variations in provision and coverage, while the systems themselves were far from uniform, but there was a common trend. Now, following a second great war, there could be no retreat from the building of a fully fledged welfare state. Expectations were even higher, and states had no choice but to address them. Politicians of all colours, liberals and conservatives, as well as leaders of labour movements, pressed, if with different agendas, for a wider welfare net. Even under the regimentation of fascist regimes, mass mobilisation had increased expectations of a better future, including state welfare. Promises of improved living standards, new housing, comprehensive social insurance, extended leisure facilities, and a car for every family, the people's car or Volkswagen, were part of Nazism's appeal, and much the same was true of fascism in Mussolini's Italy. The promises remained largely unfulfilled before the descent into catastrophic war. But the expectation that the state would provide the framework for such material prosperity and improvements in welfare survived the demise of fascism and were taken up by post-war governments. In Britain, the feeling was universal that the sacrifices made by the people in the total war had this time to be honoured by the state in ensuring that the full employment that the conflict had brought would be sustained, that social welfare and medical care would be available for all, and that the poverty and deprivation of the 1930s could never return. In 1944, the British government committed itself to a programme of full employment, necessary for the success of the social insurance measures proposed by William Beveridge in his report 2 years earlier. Social policy would obviously be high on the agenda of the post-war government. It would be as well, however, not to exaggerate the extent of social change in Europe during the first half of the 20th century. The position of women in society underlines the point. Before the First World War, feminist movements had been relatively strong, especially in pressing for the vote for women in Scandinavia and Britain, where the campaigns of the suffragettes had done much to draw the issue to wider public attention. But the movements for women's rights had been far weaker in Catholic parts of Europe, notably in the east and south of the continent, where liberal forms of constitutional government were little developed. In German-speaking Central Europe, feminist movements had won support mainly among middle-class women. Their progress had been limited, however, since they were largely squeezed between the male domains of reactionary conservatism and socialism, which saw the quest for women's emancipation as a subordinate strand in the wider struggle for social and economic transformation. The First World War had brought about the breakthrough, at least on the issue of women's votes in many countries. The recognition of the vital contribution by women in the war effort had led to a change in the attitude towards women's suffrage. And after the war, women had been given the vote in most of Europe. But France extended the franchise to women only in 1944, Italy in 1946, Romania and Yugoslavia the same year, Belgium in 1948. Greece followed even later, in 1952, after the country's civil war. In neutral Switzerland, women gained the vote at the federal level only in 1971, in individual cantons at various times from 1958, and in tiny Liechtenstein as late as 1984. Beyond voting rights, women's status at home and in the workplace was little changed. Society was still completely male-dominated. In Britain, the Beveridge report left the wife dependent on her husband's social insurance contributions and benefits, while the French Constitution of 1946 still emphasized a woman's fulfillment of her role as mother. Women remained largely discriminated against in the labor market. This was particularly the case with married women, who continued to be regarded mainly as housewives and childbearers. The high ranks of the professions remained largely close to them. Paid employment was, for the most part, still in what were seen as women's jobs: nursing, welfare, primary school teaching, secretarial work, or shop assistance. In education, too, women continued to be grossly disadvantaged. Certainly, there was an upward trend across Europe between 1900 and 1940 in the numbers of women studying at universities. This was part of more than a doubling of still small student numbers over that period, but women played only a minor part in that growth. Before the Second World War, the proportion of women among students was below a fifth across Western Europe, at its highest with nearly a third in Finland and more than a quarter in France, Britain, and Ireland, but dropping to only 7 to 8% in Spain and Greece. With so many young men called up to the armed services, the numbers of women in universities increased during the Second World War. But the big changes here, as in the position of women more generally, would only come about decades later. The extent of social mobility was also far smaller than might be imagined. Certainly the immense destruction, colossal disruption to the world economy and political upheavals that stretched across the era of two world wars, interspersed with the Great Depression, inevitably made great inroads, especially into the wealth of the landed elite. Expropriation of property was, of course, a hallmark of the Bolshevik Revolution. Despite much resistance from landowners, a substantial redistribution of land also took place, for instance, in Poland, Czechoslovakia, Romania, and Bulgaria. The entire era that spanned the wars was a massive interruption to long-term trends of capital accumulation and growth of wealth. Nevertheless, those with wealth and social standing on the eve of the war tended still to retain them when the conflict was over, except those parts of Eastern Europe that now fell under Soviet domination. In Britain, which hadn't experienced enemy occupation, institutional and social continuities were more plainly evident than in most of Europe. Social elites indeed suffered significant inroads into their wealth through higher taxation, the requisitioning of their property for the armed services, or the loss of much of their estate to pay death duties. In particular, the wealth of the landed aristocracy, the country gentry, and other private owners of large-scale capital was often drastically reduced. And, as they frequently bemoaned, domestic servants were hard to find. Young women were no longer entering the long-term drudgery of domestic service in the homes of the upper classes. The patrician lifestyle of the pre-war years had largely vanished. But there was little loss of status. While in England and Wales a mere 1% of the adult population still owned half of the total capital holdings in 1946 to 47. In France, there were some shifts in political and economic elites. New men, women of course, are only exceptionally, who had gained prestige from their role in the resistance, replaced the pre-war, often discredited leaders of the Third Republic and the Vichy collaborators. At the local level, however, once the worst of the collaborators had been purged, there was much continuity. In Italy, too, when the immediate post-war purges of committed fascists came to an end, and the communists were forced out of the new government, the political class was left not radically altered. In the economy, once the dust started to settle, the families that had controlled Italy's business before the war and in the south owned the big latifundia, the great landed estates, were largely the same as before. As in France and elsewhere, however, a new, more technocratic and entrepreneurial class soon started to gain ground in Italian industry, while in big concerns such as Pirelli and Fiat, powerful trade unions were the guarantors of a new climate in the workplace. It's easy, too, to underestimate the extent of the changes that took place in the state bureaucracy and judicial system, in the central government and in the provinces, after the fall of fascism, especially where, as in much of the north, control of towns and cities was in the hands of the left. Members of the German upper class had been prominent in the plot to kill Hitler in July 1944. However, the upper class had also presided over some terrible atrocities. It had been overrepresented in the army leadership, and also in the top ranks of the SS. Many business leaders were closely involved in expropriation of property, the ruthless exploitation of the occupied countries, slave labour, and the economics of genocide. Some of the worst cases would eventually be punished in post-war Allied trials, but levels of continuity in the elites in Western Germany remained surprisingly high, even across the devastation of 1945, except where they had lost their lands to war and occupation, as had estate owners in the eastern provinces. Overall, the political and economic elites had tended to reproduce themselves throughout the first half of the 20th century. More significant changes would come during the second half. Upward mobility into the elites remained uncommon. A partial exception among the major belligerent powers was Germany, where the Nazi Party and its many affiliations had facilitated some social climbing. Something similar could be seen in fascist Italy, but the extent of this is easy to exaggerate. A greater degree of change came later. Even the claim sometimes made that bombs knew no social differences and fell on rich and poor alike wasn't true. The poorer parts of the population, huddled in the crowded tenements and slums of industrial towns and cities, were far more likely to experience the worst of the bombing. More salubrious middle-class suburbs and the stately homes on landed estates had much better chances of escaping unscathed. What a later era would come to call the cycle of deprivation still prevailed for the most part. Soldiers returning home from the Second World War generally went back to the sort of occupation that they had left when they joined up. Their social class was usually unchanged. So were the milieu that shaped their lives. The long-term trend from the countryside to the towns meant a bigger industrial working class, usually accommodated in poor quality housing close to town centres, with little chance of upward mobility into the middle or professional classes. Possibilities of moving into less elevated, white-collar clerical or administrative work were, however, widening as the service sector expanded throughout Europe, though at different rates of growth. Educational opportunities were still minimal for those born without social advantages. In rural areas, the drop in population, the presence of fewer young people in the villages, and the diminution in available farm labourers were indicators of long-term change, intensified by the demands of the war economy. On farms, in the more remote parts of Europe, physically untouched by war, where mechanisation and modern transport had hardly penetrated, the daily routines would have been familiar to a generation 50 years earlier. Much the same was true of the daily life of the factory worker, less grinding to be sure than it had been before the First World War and with shorter hours, but still recognisable to an earlier generation of workers. In the areas of Europe most devastated by the Second World War, mainly stretching from Germany across Eastern and Southern Europe to the Western regions of the Soviet Union, There was little or no pre-war normality to return to. Huge tracts of Ukraine, Belarus, and Poland had been laid waste, both during the ravages of the fighting and genocidal killing, worse here than anywhere else in Europe, and by scorched earth destruction as the Germans retreated. In Germany itself, where the refusal to capitulate inflicted colossal destruction on the country as defeat loomed, two-thirds of the population were displaced in one way or another as the war ended. Millions of soldiers were in captivity, most of those, almost 3 million, who had surrendered to the Western Allies were gradually released by 1948, but the last of a further 3 million in Soviet hands only in 1955. The civilian population, swollen by the huge influx of refugees from the eastern provinces, shoehorned into overcrowded accommodation, 50% of housing in the big cities had been destroyed, and cowed by total defeat, faced an uncertain future. They were glad, however, if they had managed to find their part of the country as war ended, occupied by the Western Allies and not by the feared and detested Soviets. For not just the immense loss of life and the devastation of the economy, but the character of political power mattered more than anything else. The contours of their lives in the divided Germany in the immediate post-war years would be determined largely by the interests of the occupiers, in the West by the Americans, British, and French, in the East by the Soviets. For the Soviet population, the sense of triumph at the great victory and, no doubt, relief at having survived was one side of the coin. The other was the mourning for millions of lost loved ones, or the attempt to rebuild lives when their towns and villages had been obliterated by the enemy. The end of the war saw the continuation of a little-changed Stalinist system, now in fact strengthened and legitimized by wartime glory. It was still characterized by expropriations, heavy impositions of delivery or productivity quotas, exposure to the arbitrariness of the police state, and the inhumane treatment of millions of prisoners of war, those deemed unreliable, and conscripts deployed in the rebuilding of roads and railways. This system was now imposed on most of Eastern Europe, which had comprised the poorest parts of the continent even before the First World War. Now, on top of the immense suffering and devastation suffered in the Second, those countries were to be sealed off from the economic impetus that would soon breathe new life into Western Europe. Prospects of economic recovery. In the international economy, the Second World War accentuated the long-term trend that had already been marked following the first, of Europe's declining share of world production and trade. It also marked the definitive subordination of Britain to the USA as the dominant economic power in the world. Again, a development already pronounced since the First World War, but now completely confirmed by the demands of war financing in the Second. As British debts soared to meet the war effort, economic dependency on America, which had emerged from the conflict as the world's industrial giant, became overwhelming. By the end of the war, Britain was financially on its knees, the USA economically booming, the outright winner of the Second World War. Industrial production there had been greater during the war than at any earlier period of its history. Output had increased by 15% a year, compared with 7% during the First World War. And the productive capacity of the economy is estimated to have grown by 50%. By 1944, no less than 40% of the world's armaments were produced in America. As British exports dwindled, American exports soared, two-thirds higher in 1944 than they had been in 1939. The strength of its economy enabled the USA to go a long way towards financing the Allied war effort through the scheme of Lend-Lease, a brainwave of President Roosevelt that Congress agreed to back in the spring of 1941. This allowed the USA to supply its allies with loans of equipment rather than demand payment from overstretched, grossly indebted countries. By the end of the war, the total value of American Lend-Lease exports had reached over $32 billion, of which nearly $14 billion went to Britain and an invaluable $9 billion to the Soviet Union, which was provided with foodstuffs, machine tools, lorries, tanks, aircraft, railway, track, and locomotives. America was the paymaster of the war. It would soon become the paymaster of the peace. Its economic supremacy gave the USA the determining hand before the war was over in shaping the institutional arrangements for the post-war economy for the half of Europe that didn't fall under Soviet rule after 1945, though the full impact of these decisions was only felt in later decades. During most of July 1944, a month after Allied troops had landed in Normandy, more than 700 delegates from the 44 Allied countries that constituted the United Nations met for a conference in an American hotel in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, somewhat uncomfortably since the hotel was too small and in a poor state of repair. They tried to work out the principles of a global economic order for the post-war world that would permanently overcome the disasters which had given rise to economic nationalism, the Great Depression, and the triumph of fascism during the 1930s. The most important delegations were the British and the American. But it was obvious which now ruled the roost. Some of the key ideas behind the agreement reached on the last day of the conference had been put forward by the head of the British delegation, John Maynard Keynes, who had come to understand the dangers of the economic orthodoxy that had prevailed during the Depression, and whose counter-cyclical theories advocating state intervention and deficit spending to overcome mass unemployment had gained significant influence during the war. But where the British and Americans diverged in their views, the interests of the United States, voiced by the head of the U.S. delegation, Harry Dexter White, prevailed. The Bretton Woods Conference established a new monetary order, largely Keynes's inspiration, of freely convertible currencies, their exchange rates pegged to the U.S. dollar, to replace the earlier discredited gold standard. The first big test of convertibility would, however, fail miserably in summer 1947, when Britain was forced to revoke the convertibility of sterling in the midst of financial crisis and heavy demands for exchange of sterling into dollars, seriously depleting dollar holdings. Two proposals by White would eventually take shape as significant post-war institutions. An International Stabilization Fund, which became the International Monetary Fund, aimed at correcting budgetary problems of individual states while retaining stability within the system. And an International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, which turned into the World Bank, to provide necessary capital for post-war reconstruction, though its initial provisions were in fact small relative to what was needed. Conference participants also recognized the need for a further institution to establish rules for liberalized global trade. This, however, never came to fruition, and international trade relations were eventually regulated under the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT, reached in 1947 and initially signed by 23 nations. Whatever the insurmountable political obstacles that prevented the initial success of Bretton Woods, the conference marked a determination that there could be no return to the disasters of the interwar era. It was an indicator of the acceptance that the basis of the capitalist economy itself had to be reformed if a repeat of the breakdown of international trade and finance that had spawned the catastrophe were to be avoided. The US dollar, it was plain, had to take over from the weakened pound sterling as the pivot of international finance. The Americans were more than happy with that, as they were with the agreed liberalization of trade. Europeans, too, accepted this as a basic premise of the post-war economic order. But there was a different emphasis. For the British and the French, state intervention on a scale unimaginable before the war had become essential, not simply for reconstruction, but to combat the vagaries of unconstrained capitalist economics and to prevent any return of mass unemployment. The resulting compromise, not applicable to the Soviet bloc, of course, was an emerging mixed economy of liberal free trade and state direction. Capitalism was everywhere reformed to some extent, though not radically changed or fundamentally challenged, apart from by the rapidly dwindling numbers of adherents of communist parties, struggling to retain support as the Cold War took shape. Although it was hard to foresee in the devastation of 1945, the mixture of economic liberalism and social democracy, what the Germans came to call social market economy, soziale Marktwirtschaft, would come to provide untold prosperity and serve Western Europe well, politically, for the next 30 years. An important precondition for the success of this combination after 1945 hadn't existed following the First World War. No attempt was made by the Western Allies to impose heavy reparation payments. In Germany's Eastern Zone, it was a different matter, as had been done in 1919, with such baleful consequences for Germany and for other defeated nations. For a short time in 1944, the Morgenthau Plan, which proposed reducing post-war Germany to the status of a pre-industrial economy, thereby handing a propaganda gift to the Nazi regime, was given serious consideration. Although Roosevelt and Churchill agreed on notable restrictions to future levels of German industrial output, the futility of permanently impoverishing 70 million people and crippling the economic key to European recovery was swiftly recognized, all the more so once the Cold War set in. The Iron Curtain would itself come to be an indirect advantage to the western half of the continent, while condemning the eastern part to an unenviable fate. This was a vast human tragedy for the peoples trapped behind it. No price can be placed on the deprivation of freedom that would last for more than four decades. But the loss to the heavy hand of Soviet oppression of those parts of Europe that after the First World War had been racked by ethnic conflict, nationalist violence and border disputes benefited the already wealthier parts of Europe in the West. These countries, unlike those of the emerging Soviet bloc, were able to take advantage of American support in rebuilding their ruined economies. The Europeans had seemed bent on destroying their own economic foundations between 1914 and 1945. That the next 30 years, in astonishing contrast, would bring for many in the West continued and unprecedented prosperity was utterly unimaginable in the ruins of 1945. Sustained prosperity would transform living standards in Western Europe. But even in the very different conditions of Eastern Europe too, living standards would rise, and for the mass of the population far outstrip what they had been during the troubled interwar years. The European nations would have been incapable of bringing this transformation about themselves. In the separate halves of the continent, they were heavily dependent upon the two new superpowers, the USA and USSR, for the reconstruction, in diametrically opposed ways, of their economic substance. economically as well as politically, the two halves of Europe were set after 1945 to go their separate ways. Christian churches, challenge and continuity. How people framed their lives beyond the precarious task of securing a livelihood was still overwhelmingly influenced by the morality and values of the Christian churches. Europe remained in the first half of the 20th century a Christian continent, lying west of the officially atheistic Soviet Union and northwest of Turkey, a secular state with a Muslim population. The churches still wielded enormous social and ideological power, especially among the peasantry and the middle classes, and they used it as the Christian churches were everywhere swept into the political convulsions that rocked Europe after the First World War. Friedrich Nietzsche, the German philosopher, had famously announced already in 1882 that God is dead. It was a premature obituary. During the first half of the 20th century, the Christian churches certainly felt themselves to be on the defensive against the threat posed by modern society, above all, atheistic Bolshevism. Indeed, as people turned to the state, to political movements, or to other public institutions to answer their needs, the churches, in the eyes of increasing numbers, had nothing to offer. Nationalism is the new religion. People don't go to church. They go to nationalist meetings, said Count Hojnicki. One of the characters in Joseph Roth's gloomy view of modernity in his evocative 1932 novel, The Radetzky March. Max Weber's disenchantment of the world meant that mystical beliefs in sacramental ritual, salvation, redemption, and eternal happiness in an afterlife were losing their appeal. And as war and genocide ravaged Europe, Nietzsche's attack on belief in rationality and truth, his denial of morality rooted in religious belief, came to seem anything but misplaced. The churches couldn't come out of this era untarnished. Yet neither the loss of belief nor fall in the numbers of followers of the main Christian denominations should be exaggerated or predated. After two world wars, that influence remained profound. For all their travails, the Christian churches survived the catastrophic first half of the 20th century remarkably intact. Their main problems would come later. The start of the First World War had given Christianity a boost. God was, it seemed, on everyone's side as war broke out. At any rate, the Christian churches in every belligerent power claimed God's support for their cause. God with us, Gott mit uns, said the Germans. God is on our side, Dieu est de notre côté, claimed the French, as they declared a sacred union, Union Sacrée, to defend their country. Other countries were equally quick to blend patriotism with Christianity. The clergy readily saw the war as a national crusade, a holy war for civilization against barbarism, for good against evil. There were some pacifists, to be sure, but the majority of the clergy overwhelmingly backed their country's war. They blessed the troops going into battle and the arms with which they fought. They prayed for the success of imminent offensives. Nationalism everywhere swallowed the basic tenets of Christianity. For purported men of peace, the belligerency of the clergy could be resounding. In an Advent sermon in 1915, the Anglican Bishop of London, Arthur Winnington Ingram, exhorted British soldiers to kill the good as well as the bad, to kill the young men as well as the old. Though his Prime Minister, Herbert Asquith, thought this was the rant of a singularly stupid bishop. One church leader, at least, consistently proclaimed his neutrality and exhorted the nations to conclude a just peace. In 1917, Pope Benedict XV, elected in September 1914, put forward a peace plan that advocated international arbitration, evacuation of occupied territories, renunciation of war indemnities, and reduction in armaments. For his pains, the Pope was decried as a secret partisan, a hypocrite who wouldn't admit his preferences.